Heard of the rich young ruler and his obviously wrong choice, but it has set me to thinking, no matter how much wealth he had, he could not ride in a car, have any surgery, turn on a light, buy penicillin, hear a pipe organ, listen to the radio, watch TV, go through a drive-thru, instantly heat a meal, wash dishes in running water, type a letter, or even purchase white paper and a Bic pen, mow a lawn, fly in an airplane, sleep on an inner spring mattress, talk on the phone, email, or use a computer. If he was rich, what am I? Today we're talking about stuff. Mammon, moolah, the grab, how to get it, how to give it. And for years, you know, we've been married now for 13? Yeah, I got it right. 13, yeah, I had to make sure. 13 wonderful years. And, well, at least 5 or 6 of them have been wonderful. And Colleen's never gotten me every Christmas and birthday she'll get me something and then I end up taking it back. And she's got it. She doesn't seem to bother her too much. She seems to be all right with it most of the time, you know, and she's just kind of learning that that's the way I am. But this year, for my birthday, she got me something that I absolutely loved. Now, in our house, we have a plethora of things. You know, we have remote controls. And, right, Dad? So, you know, you got a remote control for the TV, and then you got one for the DVD player, and one for the VCR, and our stereo's too old to have a remote for that, so you got to go up and push the buttons for that thing. And then we got the universal remote that does the VCR, the TV, and the DVD player. But we're always losing them. Always losing them. You know, they get stuck in the couch, and you can't find them. And so Colleen came up with the perfect solution, which is also very fitting, because now that I'm 40, I can't see the buttons quite as well as I used to. Not wearing the glasses yet, Sam, but, you know, the day's coming. So, remote control of all remote controls, this is what you need. We have yet to lose this remote control. Yeah, and you can see the buttons clearly, Sam. It's wonderful. Well, even in the dark, it's great. And it was pretty cheap, I think. And this is what you need right here. Now, if this is not the epitome of where we are in America, that we need another remote control, right? Now, you know, we gauge ourselves by comparing ourselves to others, which is probably not the best thing to do, but yet the passages we're going to be looking at are talking about wealth and riches and our attitude towards them primarily. We got to keep in mind, really, he's talking to us. No matter how difficult you had a time paying your bills this week or month, he's talking to us. And because there's no way you can compare our status with the majority of the rest of the world and not come up with the conclusion that we are in the category of rich versus not rich. That's okay. We'll see where that takes us this morning. As long as the computer wakes up. Okay. All right. We here's where we were. Consider trials joy for endurance. Let endurance have its perfect and complete effect. God gives wisdom when asked. Don't waver, but ask in faith. Receive nothing when you are double-minded or unstable. That's where we've been. This is where we're getting to. I'll ask you to help me out with this. And if you'll kind of do the yellow part and I'll do the white part. We'll all read together in the yellow. Now the believer of humble means should take pride in his position. This is like responsive reading. But the rich person's pride should be in his humiliation, because he will pass away like the wildflower in the meadow. For the sun rises with its heat and dries up the meadow. The petal of the flower falls off and its beauty is lost forever. So also the rich person in the midst of his pursuits will wither away. Happy is the one who endures testing, because when he is proven to be genuine, he will receive the crown of life that God has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he is tempted, "I am tempted by God." For God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each one is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desires. Then when desire conceives, it gives birth to sin, and when sin is full grown, it gives birth to death. Do not be led astray, my dear brothers and sisters. All generous giving and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or the slightest hint of change. Three things to note as we begin to break into this passage that we're looking at. Number one, the repeated use of lowly. Lowly is repeated here twice, although in most translations it doesn't come out for whatever reason. Inconsistency in translation. But he says, let the lowly brother exalt or glory in his exaltation, but the rich in his humiliation. That's the same word as lowly. So let the lowly brother exalt in his exaltation. So there, what you have here is a teeter-totter, right? The lowly brother is going to be exalted, and the one who is rich is going to be brought low, because as a flower of the field, he will pass away. So this lowly is repeated here for both of these. Number two, contrast between the lowly and the rich. Now, the word lowly could have many meanings to us. If we just had the word lowly in there, could be humble in spirit, humble in actions, humble in leadership, humble in whatever. But the contrast to rich, but the rich, as the opposite of lowly, gives us a clear, obvious, probably connotation or denotation for the meaning of lonely. Now, in a moment, you'll see that James is full of stuff that talks about riches, wealth, poorness, etc. But with the one exception of verse 9 right here, the statements are directed at the rich. How they should act, how they should think, how they should treat the poor. This is the only statement made directly to the poor or to the ones that aren't rich. And it's even kind of rather vague. He says, just glory in his exaltation. Doesn't tell you what the exaltation is, doesn't tell you what that means. Now, he'll talk about the exaltation in a later passage as he's talking to the rich person. But in the direct statement, this is the only direct statement that says, hey, those that aren't rich, do this. And then everything else in James, all the many verses that talk about wealth or riches or whatever, is directed to the ones that already have as opposed to the ones that don't. So we want to keep that in mind. It's kind of interesting. And then number three, the third point I want to make about this is that there are two descriptions of what happens to the rich. Excuse me. Notice what it says. It says, the lowly brother, that was point number one. Lowly brother is made rich. Lowly is equal to poor. And then point number three is that the rich will both pass away and the rich will fade away. Now, what's the difference between those two things that he's talking about here? Well, pass away. Assuredly, I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, in Matthew chapter 5:18, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law until all of it is fulfilled. The word here is a good translation. It comes and goes. It's here, it's gone. It's just kind of passing by. And then fading away, this is a kind of interesting word. The word is moron. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt gets moronic, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. Now, when you think of salt losing its flavor, you don't think of salt becoming dumb. But that's really what it's really our word for moron kind of transmuted from that. It loses something. When you're a moron, you have lost your ability to think properly, draw good conclusions. You've lost something very specific in how we come to use the word today. But in its origin, its original sense, it just means to kind of fade away, to break up, and to lose some of its pieces. So the rich are going to kind of fade away and become morons, right? Something like that. So there's what happens. He will pass away, use of things that come and go, emphasizes the irrevocable, temporary nature of a thing. Irrevocable in that once it's gone, it's gone. And it's temporary in that it will eventually be gone. And fade away emphasizes the gradual dissolving nature of a thing. It's also used specifically of organic matter. And thus he uses it in the illustration here about the flower. When you think about you give your wife some flowers, which I do, very regularly. And, well, regularly, not very often, but it's regular. And so you get those nice flowers, and they smell real nice, except for, what are those? Lily can't stand the smell of lilies. They just bug me for some reason. But anyhow, you get the nice flowers, and they smell real nice, and you put them in the vase or the vase, and they sit there. And then you come back to the house one day, and you go, man, our house really smells bad. What is that? What's those beautiful, lovely flowers that smelled so nice to begin with, and now they're stinking the house up? Why? Because they're dissolving. And I'll never forget when we were first married, we come home, and it's like, wow, what is, I think we'd come back from our honeymoon, is that when it was? Oh man, it was, and we were looking all over the house, so we thought something had died, like behind the walls, a rat or something. Oh, this is terrible, horrible, it was the worst smell ever, and we're looking, and we don't see anything, but these potatoes we had rotted, and rotten potatoes, man, I'll tell you what, I would not want to live in Ireland. I guess it smells like that all over Ireland. I don't know. Probably not. But, it was horrible. Why? That organic material begins to dissolve and break away and break down. And that's the picture of what he's talking about here. The rich will become moronic and lose something, dissolve and break up. And the substance of what is there, what it is that it's not. He's not really even talking about the rich person. Although that's what he says. The rich man will also fade away in his pursuits. But it's the things that he's doing more so than even the person itself. So the rich will be a moron in his pursuits. It wouldn't be too far off of a translation. And that's the point of everything negative the Bible has to say about riches. The pursuit thereof excludes us from the pursuit of things above. This is the key. The pursuit thereof excludes us from the things above. Here's an interesting statistic I found off of Barna. As income increases, so does your agreement with the statement that it is your personal responsibility to share your faith with others. That was kind of interesting. What's also interesting about it, though, is that you know there's a clear distinction between less than $35,000 and above $35,000, and I'm not sure exactly what year this was taken, but I think it's fairly recent. So less than $35,000, category other than $35,000. But when you get above $60,000, doesn't really make much of a difference, does it? So once you've gotten to the point of a little bit comfortable, I guess, then for some reason you feel less personally responsible to share Christ with others. And once you get really comfortable, it doesn't make any difference either. But it's interesting that there's a difference that income makes in our personal responsibility to share Christ with others. Why is that? I don't know exactly, but it must have something to do with the fact that our pursuit of wealth, riches, and the emphasis thereof certainly can interfere with the pursuit of things above. Doesn't have to. Doesn't need to be. Obviously, you can not meet these categories whatsoever and still fall into one or the other. But okay, now anytime, here's a summary of all the verses on the book of James about wealth and riches and stuff. Now, anytime I put up a list like this, and it doesn't matter what it is, but it doesn't take long for the eyelids to start to drop. So please bear with me. I think there's something I want you to kind of see the gist of this before we go into it, the broad scope of the verses that James is going to be talking about here regarding riches and lucre and mammon and getting and receiving stuff. And hopefully I can put this all together for us in the end. In verse 9... we just looked at this in chapter 1. The poor take pride in their high position. The rich pride in their humility. That will fade. The rich will wither in their pursuits. The test endurer, we'll see here in a minute, gets the crown of life. The tempted, temptation is a result of yielding to desires, which results in sin, which results in death. What does that have to do with wealth? We'll see that in a second. All generous giving is from above. So there's something about receiving and getting. Chapter 2, no favor should be given toward the wealthy. Doing so is like judging with evil motives. Verse 5, the poor are rich in favor. Show prejudice, and that's sin, and you'll be convicted. Verse 15, brotherly is poorly clothed, and you say, in chapter 4. Chapter 3, we got a break. James says, I'm going to give you a little break from all this money stuff, and we'll get back to it in chapter 4. In chapter 4, why do you have wars? It's from your internal passions, your desire for stuff, for things, for whatever. Verse 4, friendship with the world is enmity with God. You want the stuff, enemy of God. Verse 13, plan to do this, that, and the other, and go make a profit, he says. Well, life is like vanishing smoke. Chapter 5, the rich will weep. Chapter 5, verse 2, riches have rotted and rusted. Wealth will be a witness against you. Holding back pay cries out against you, and you have lived indulgently. So there it is. Everything we didn't need to know from James about riches and stuff. Now, hopefully what you'll see, though, is that there is a consistent theme throughout all of this thing, and they really do mesh together very nicely. It's amazing, though, in how short a book of James is, how much he talks about, he goes back to this subject of stuff. And, you know, you can do a study in the Bible on, you look up riches or wealth or money in one of the topical concordance tools, and you'll find Proverbs had a bunch of verses about it, and you'll find James has a bunch of verses about it, and then there's a verse here and a verse there and a verse here and a verse there, and that's it. I mean, there's a lot to say about money in the Bible, but there's nothing nearly as concentrated as James, except for the book of Proverbs, maybe. So let's get down to the heart of the matter here, going on to this passage. Let the lowly brother glory in his exaltation, but the rich in his humiliation, because as a flower of the field he will pass away. Blessed is a man that endures temptation, goes on to say, for when he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Now, this looks like a new topic. Blessed is a man who endures temptation. So he's right there, verse 11, you just see that. So the rich man will also fade away in his pursuits. And what happens as you're reading through the book of James, it's natural to just kind of look at this as a book of Proverbs. I mean, you go, and there's some validity to seeing that. But you go, okay, there's verse 11, he's talking about wealth and riches and stuff. And then verse 12, he's new subject, right? But look, there really is a tie between these two things. Look what happens when he does endure. First of all, he'll receive the crown of life. Now, what does it take to receive that crown of life? I just said it. What do you got to do to get the crown of life? You got to endure. You got to endure temptation. Now, what may be a great temptation? What? Stuff. Maybe the pursuit of wealth which aggravates a relationship with the Lord. Maybe that is a great temptation. Now, how do I know what kind of temptation he's talking about? Well, the next verse. So here he receives an eternal reward in exchange for for enduring an earthly temptation. And the next verse says, but each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Now, I suppose all sorts of desires could be at hand here. You could be talking about any kind of desires, and that certainly is true. But the context seems to bear out one thing in particular. He's still talking about stuff. Kind of reminds you of chapter 4, which says you want, but you don't have, because you're asking wrong, blah, blah, blah. It's that kind of a thing. So just so we don't miss it, just to have or to get or receive is not bad. That's all right. Good gifts are from our Father. And that's what he's going to go on to tell us. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there's variation and shadow of turning. So having, getting, receiving the stuff, that's not bad. Literally here, but by the way, this is interesting that this says every good gift, and literally that's every gift giving. Every good gift giving. The verb there is emphasizing the giving of the gift. It's not, if you just read what it says right there, it looks like every good gift and every perfect gift, that's the same kind of thing. But really it's the, one is the act of giving and one is the gift itself. So every good gift giving and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights. So having something good, that's not bad. We have a lot of it. I got something really good right here. Works great. That's good. But there's an emphasis here that he's getting towards, and we'll see more of that here. So hang on to that. All generous giving and every perfect gift is from above. So let's look at some of the contrast, and hopefully some of this will kind of show itself up. Blessed is a man. I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. There's lowly and there's rich. There's exaltation and there's low bringing. There's temptation versus temptation and the endurance thereof, which is contrasting to the rich man, which fades. There's a contrast between the crown of life and the crown of the field. What is the flower? It's the beauty of the fields, that crown, so to speak. There is a contrast between our own desires and the love for the Lord. How do you love the Lord? What? All your heart, all your mind, all your soul. Well, that kind of contrasts to your own desires, doesn't it? Now, hopefully, your desires are the Lord's desires, and so that ends up being a good thing. But here, the context is your own desires as opposed to the Lord's desires, and that kind of is opposite to the love of the Lord, isn't it? How about the temporary, fading, dissolving self-achievements as opposed to the good gift and perfect gift? One, you know, if you get a gift from someone and it works great, and then it just starts dissolving on you, well, that's a bummer. You know, eventually this one will die too, or we'll lose it in the couch somehow. Cats will eat it, you know. But the perfect gift from above, or the gift from above, is perfect. How about this contrast? From the earth or from the self versus, in other words, his pursuits, that which is from your own abilities, versus that which comes from the Father of lights. There's a big difference between those two. And then finally, the difference between a perishing beauty of the field and the riches versus no variation with the Father. One is fading and constantly changing and diminishing in quality and all of that. The other one has no variation whatsoever, constant and steady. Now, blessed is a man that endures temptation. But look at what happens when he does not endure. When a person does not endure, what happens? What's the contrast? What? Doesn't get the crown of life. And again, it takes enduring to receive the crown of life. So we want to catch this, that there's a great contrast that he's setting up here. And the key is this. One can be a distraction from service to the Lord, and anything that is a distraction from service, obedience, and a heart towards the Lord, a love of the Lord, is something that is evil. So there's two teams, right? You got the Lord's team and the other team, or you got the what team were we on the other day? The Panthers. We were on the Panthers team. And then there was the other team. And, you know, you got to cheer and hooray for the Panthers. Well, you got to cheer and hooray for the Lord's team. And if you're doing anything that causes points for the other team, well, we'll see what he says about that here in just a minute. So more about the stuff. My brethren, do not hold the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, with partiality. For if there should come into your assembly a man with gold rings and fine apparel, and there should also come in a poor man in filthy clothes, and you pay attention to the one wearing the fine clothes and say to him, you sit here in good place, and say to the poor man, why don't you stand over there because you smell too much, or sit here at my footstool. Have you not shown partiality among yourselves and become judges with evil thoughts? Listen, my beloved brethren, has God not chosen the poor of this world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom which he promised to those who love him? Billy Sunday it was a very forceful pulpit pounding preacher, and the story goes that he one day he was kind of a rotating preacher. He'd go around to different churches and areas and travel the country, an itinerant preacher. And one day he was going to be preaching at a church, and back in those days, you know, you didn't have, he wasn't on TV, so no one really knew what Billy Sunday looked like, or most people didn't. And so when he got to this church, he dressed up like a bum, and he put on just nasty looking clothes and you know, made himself look dirty and everything. And he came into church, and just to see how people would treat him. And then the preacher of that church was in on it, because then he asked the guest speaker to come and speak, and I guess there was quite a shock when the bum, who'd been nicely escorted to one part of the church to sit at, was to get up and give the presentation. And honestly, someone came into church and they looked like they were right off the streets, and they smelled, and they were looking, you know, pretty scary. I'm not sure I'd clear off my seat right there next to me and my kids, right? So, you know, how do we deal with that? Well, I don't know. But here's the thing. God has not chosen the poor of this world. Has he not chosen the poor of this world to be rich in faith? Now, does that mean that just if you're poor, that you are rich in faith? I mean, the key here is, if you want to do well in heaven, you want to be poor now. And so where's the offering place? We need to get them back out again, and we'll send them back out and empty out all your pockets, and that way you can do better in heaven, right? Because that's what he says. Has he not chosen the poor of this world to be rich in faith? Oh, but there's another part to that, and which he promised to those who loved him. So there's a key that goes along with this thing. Now this is very much like the previous passage. There's a contrast between the reality you think that exists out there and the eternal reality, the way we view or judge the world, and the way God does. And again, the emphasis is on the reward for the poor. So in chapter 1, we know one thing, and here we know another. Now, you should be getting a sense for a real contrast that's being presented here. The real problem that riches and their pursuits do create. In chapter 1, blessed is a man who endures temptation, for when he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. There is something that goes on here, and there is a receipt for enduring. If you love the Lord and you endure temptation, you get a crown of life. If you're poor, you're rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom of God. Well, both of those are the same kind of deal. But if you show partiality, you commit sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. So here's the contrast. Endure temptation, crown of life. Poor, rich in faith, heirs of the kingdom. How do those two things go together? Well, one is talking about eternity. They're both talking about eternity, what you're going to get, what's going to happen, what are the rewards. And both of them are a contrast between an emphasis one way versus an emphasis on something else. But if you show partiality, and here's a different contrast, you commit sin or convicted by the law. Let's go on. We'll put it all together here as we move on. Verse 14 of chapter 2. But what does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can faith save him? If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to him, depart in peace, be warmed and filled, but you do not give them what the things that are needed for the body, what does it profit? So someone says, hey, you know, I'm really down and out. And you go, well, good luck. May it be well with you. I'm sure everything will work out. We have the means to help them out. Well, then we've done them a disservice. We may have faith, but we don't have works. And so you have because you've received what? Why is it that we have? This is someone that's coming to someone that has something. And how did this person have something to begin with? Every good gift And every good gift giving is from above, from the Father of lights, with whom there's no variation or shadow of turning. So if you have, you've received from the Lord, and what you have is there to provide a means to give, and you say you have faith, and yet you're unwilling to help those who need it, well, that's not a good place to be. So this is a contrast between saying and doing. How does one get to this position in life? How does one get to the point of having faith and stuff they're not willing to use as needed? How do you get there? You know, you're either born into wealth, which in some sense all of us were, or you were born into less wealth and you achieved more over your life, which is fine. But at some point in time, the thing is, we our stuff is no longer for the purpose it was given to us for. God says, look, everything you have, I've given you. And everything you have is for me and for those who need it. And you go, well, yeah, but I'm not just going to give it away. Okay, well, there's a balance there that we have to take into account. But it never stops to be the Lord's. He's just given it to us as stewards. It's not ours. We're just merely managers of it. So how do we get from that point of going, this is something the Lord's given me, and I appreciate that, and then all of a sudden it becomes something I'm going to hold on to with everything I have and an unwillingness to give it away. The stuff in some way becomes more important than the one who gave us the stuff. And this can happen in all levels of wealth. This happens at the very most simplistic way. Don't touch my remote control. That's mine. It can happen all the way up the food chain, from the very little, from the very least to the very greatest of what we have. In chapter 4, more about the same thing. Where do wars and fights come from among you? Now that one phrase summarizes the entire theme. Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? And here's really the key. Adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. We live in a world in which it is no longer acceptable to take God with you in your life. You can't easily take him into your workforce. It's increasingly more difficult to run our governments, our schools, anything secular with a view towards Christian principles and ideas. Now, there's never been a time in history, really, where things were run according to God's law. I mean, you know, the good old days really never existed from the pure sense of the term. I love that in Proverbs, he says, or I think it's Ecclesiastes, there's a couple places in the Old Testament where he says, woe to those who say, and you read that and you go, wow, way back then, there was someone going, you know, when I was a kid, them days were good and we had it better. There's always been a day that's better in some sense. But, you know, I'd rather not go back to certain things. But things have changed. Where we sit today, not only is friendship with the world enmity with God, but friendship with God is enmity with the world and from the world. And that maybe there was a time when that wasn't so much so. The fact is that the Lord should go with us into all areas of our life. And I've been reading a little bit about this on my... I get some magazines, and so I'm reading a little bit. They're talking about this concept of worldview. And I remember in school, that was the big buzzword was worldview. What does worldview mean? And there's some statistics done, interesting, that back in the 80s, when this word began to kind of buzz around, worldview, and they did some polls. What does worldview mean? And they were like, you know, 6% of the respondents knew what worldview meant. And now the word is used, you know, all over the place. And I had a professor who's coming to class on the first day, Weltanschauung, Weltanschauung. Do you know what Weltanschauung means? Like, no, I don't speak German. That's worldview in German. And I'm like, okay, thank you. But what is your worldview? Well, worldview is, you know, how you view the world. Real simple. But it's how you view and filter everything of your thoughts, your ideas, your concept, what is right, what is wrong, what you should do, what you shouldn't do. And the worldview is becoming more and more, I got my worldview and you got your worldview, and don't you let your worldview interfere with my worldview. And whatever you do, don't let religion interfere with how we view the world and how we make influences and decisions and all that. And but the problem is that we should be taking the Lord with us in all of our activities, every one of our things that we do, and all that we do, whether it's work, play, family, and maybe even church. We should take the Lord with us into our thoughts there. Because there really are two sides. There are two teams. There's every play of the game is either in support of our team or in support of the other team. And anything that's there in support of the other team is enmity with God. It is making ourselves an enemy of God. And so this whole thing about all throughout James, about desires and wants and stuff, he's building up all of this kind of a crescendo right here. And here's the deal. You are either doing stuff for the Lord or you're doing stuff for yourself. And if you're doing stuff for yourself, that's not for the Lord. Now, can you do stuff like build wealth that's for the Lord? I hope so. Because if not, then every one of us is in trouble, I guarantee you. Because we've all built wealth as opposed to other people in the world. Now, can you build wealth that's not for the Lord? Can you go to work that's not for the Lord? Can you fill in the blank? Can you do anything? Absolutely. But should we do everything? The key here is this. Here's another one. Come now, you who say, today and tomorrow we will go to such a city and spend a year there and buy and sell and make a profit. Whereas you don't know what will happen tomorrow, for what is your life? It's even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. What's the problem here? I mean, really, how many of you have said, tomorrow I'm going to do something? Now, every time you say that, do you say, if the Lord wills? If you don't, you must be sinning, because that's what he says right here. Right? Now, I've been around people that say that. They make a point of following this passage right here. And there's nothing wrong with that, but you know, they say, I'll see you Monday, Lord willing. They never fails. They always say that. They want to make sure that they're caught. They catch themselves on this passage. I'm not going to be guilty of that. And, hey, that's one way to make sure, right? What's the point here? Look at something here. There's some different ways to summarize this passage. He talks about the uncertainty of life. He says, you don't know what's going to happen. He talks about brevity of life. There's a little time. He talks about the frailty of life. Things vanish and they go and they come and they go and they're like a vapor and they're gone. He talks about self-confidence. That's certainly an issue that's being brought out here. You boast in your arrogance. I'm going to go tomorrow. I'm going to do this, and that's the way. That's what's going to happen. Now, if that's the issue, then you got self-confidence issues. Not wrong to be self-confident, but to the point of arrogance. Or maybe here's the deal. It is planning without the Lord and boasting of the results. I think this is kind of the summary of this problem. The typical businessman, what does he do every day? That's you and me, by the way, businessman and woman. Or if you're maybe a homeschool mom. What do you do every day? Make plans? May involve travel? Maybe business-related activities or work-related activities? And what do they emphasize often, at least for business people that go to work? What's the point of making your plans? For a profit, right? Now, so if you add up all the plans that you make every day without any thought of the Lord, to just put them in a big pile, So you start to make plans. You get, and they're like scraps of paper, just begin to pile up. And eventually they look kind of like that, right? So you got all these great big plans that you've made. Now, is it wrong to make plans? We need to make plans, right? You got to have a plan. Is it wrong to make? Do you have to every single plan that you make in business? You know, tomorrow I'm going to be programming this. I'm going to be doing that, and I got to go to a meeting, and I'm going to drive up to Austin and do this, that, and the other. And every single one of those plans, I got to pray through it, and I got to think about it, and if I, you know, I'm going to be meeting with these guys, and we'll have to have prayer before our meeting. Otherwise, you know, I'm not involving the Lord, obviously, and so. They don't want to pray with me, but they're going to have to pray anyhow. That's what we have to do, right? Well, probably not exactly. But the key here is this. Everything that we do should be through the filter of service to the Lord. Now, you get through all of life, and you've got all these plans that you've made without the Lord. And what happens to him in the end? It's like a little vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. And it's gone. Now, is it wrong to make those plans? Well, you're going to make plans. And you're probably not going to include, in every single plan that you have, you're probably not going to include the Lord in all those plans. We should, yeah. You're probably not going to. But what's going to happen to the plans that didn't include the Lord? In the end, what's going to happen to them? Well, they might occur. You know, tomorrow I'm going to go to my office. Didn't include the Lord in that thought. And will I go to the office tomorrow? Most likely. Me not praying about it beforehand going to change that? Probably not. Maybe. I don't know. The Lord may decide, Eric, I'm going to show you. But in the end, in the end, what's going to happen to those plans? All the things that I do as a result of my plans, what's going to happen to them? They're just going to be gone. Nothing's going to last forever that doesn't include an eternal perspective on it. And that's the key. Look at this. In chapter 5, he really comes down hard. I mean, he's I got this last chapter, I'm writing about it, and you're going to get it if you don't get it. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches are corrupted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver are corroded, and their corrosion will be witnesses against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have heaped up treasure in the last days. Indeed, the wages of the laborers, you haven't been paying your people, and they cry out to the Lord of Sabaoth. You lived on the earth in pleasure and luxury. You fattened your hearts as in the day of slaughter. And the Lord of Sabaoth, the Lord of hosts, appears 200 times in the Old Testament or so. Primarily in the prophets. And it's the name of God that's used to represent a strong tower. It's the powerful rock upon which we can trust. Because he is the Lord of all hosts, of all power. When we fail, we are powerless or in desperate needs. It's the Lord of hosts that stands up as our strength. We can find comfort and confidence in the Lord of hosts. Now, here's a good example. For behold, he who forms mountains and creates the wind, who declares to man what his thought is, and makes the morning darkness, who treads the high places of the earth. The Lord of hosts is his name. Now who wants to go against that God? And at the end of your life, all the plans that you made, either in the category of for his team or not for his team, and it all has to do with the perspective behind those plans, and perhaps an arrogance behind them as well. Will you be like the man in Luke chapter 12? He says, what shall I do? I have no room to store my crops. And I'll do this. I'll tear down my barns, I'll build bigger ones, and I'll say to my soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take ease, eat, drink, and be merry. And the Lord will say in response, fool, this night your soul will be required of you. And then whose will those things be which you have provided? And so is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. That's the whole bottom line of what James is trying to get at here. The love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, 1 Timothy has to tell us. Now, how do you know you have a desire to be rich? How do you know you have a love of money? Because you desire to be rich. How do you know you desire to be rich, though? In verse 8. And having food and clothing, with these you shall be content. So a desire to be rich takes many forms and has various levels. For those closer to the bottom floor, it may look a little different than those already on floor 50. But the results are exactly the same, a never-ending thirst for more. J. Paul Getty, one of the very first billionaires in the world. Now they're a dime a dozen. But, they asked him, J. Paul Getty, how much is enough? And he said, just a little more. And that's the key here, is always looking for more, never satisfied with, and this is where we need to find ourselves, being content with food and clothing. It's all about the attitude. Now, if building wealth, success, money, if all of that is above and beyond contentment, if you don't need that, you are content with the food and clothing that you have, then you're in good shape. Now, I can't tell you and your family where to draw the line. What attitudes will reflect a love of money and which ones are just good stewardship. He does say every good gift and every perfect gift is from above. I kind of like to find myself at this one, Proverbs 30. This is one of my favorite verses on money. Remove falsehood and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food allotted to me, lest I be full and deny you. So, you know, you give me, don't give me too much. Then I'll go, Lord, I don't need you anymore. I got this stuff on my own. But don't let me be poor, because then I'm going to go and steal and profane the name of the Lord. So I don't want that. But remember, here's the bottom line. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above. But that doesn't include what we steal from the Lord. Right? Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above. So it's easy to look at ourselves and go, well, what I got, this is a good gift, by the way. This was obviously from the Lord because it was a good and perfect gift. But it could represent what was stolen from him. In other words, it doesn't, But it could be representative of, I got to have, and so I'm going to get, because I'm not satisfied with the food and the clothing. And that, when we do that with that attitude of not satisfied and getting to fill some other satisfaction, that's not a good gift from the Lord. That's just stealing from him. Because then you're taking time out from his team and you're serving the other. And that's friendship with the Lord is enmity with God. And so every good gift and every perfect gift is from God, but not those things that we steal from him. All right? Let's pray. Lord, thank you for the gifts you've given us, the wealth that we have, the riches, the things that you've provided for us. And I pray that you would just give us an attitude of stewardship, of gratitude, of appreciation, and that we'd be willing to use what you've given us to serve you and to help others around us. That we would have a focus and a drive to make all of our life in service to you, and so that we would not be counted as those who are enemies of you, but as friends in our actions, our attitudes, and our daily walk. And all that we say and do may be pleasing to you. And I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.